is, "It is love that exceeds the deserts of the beloved." The Germans got this down wonderfully, too, in Run, Lola, Run. Writers from Shakespeare on have adored this idea of a young woman's macho cupidity. And why wouldn't they? Who wouldn't? It flatters everyone. It is, shall we say, fantastic. Juliet, dagger plunged to chest, was pure machismo compared to Romeo and his delicate, mishandled poison. A young woman in love is a titanic force. At least it is time-honored theater to think so. And so we, or I, go to the movies. The successful communication of feeling is dependent on timing. Timing is dependent on editorial instinct. The dramatic last hour of Titanic entails glorious editing. Has there been a movie that so rhythmically and succinctly joins the smashing up of a great groaning ship with the astonishing range of brutish panic and altruistic courtesy with which our species greets catastrophe? The frenzied rush to the ropes and lifeboats, the demented elegance of Mr. Guggenheim, the small moments of fellowship and concern among the ship's musicians, the helplessness of the terrified crew, the gentle words between mother and child, are not imagined in any original fashion, yet perfectly spliced. Their heartbreaking accuracy cannot be doubted. This is, after all, a movie with more than just a mechanical interest in maritime disaster on its movie mind. It is interested, even if ham-handedly, in the human animal, social class and injustice, grief, death, and shipboard romance as existential truth. As in every steerage meets first-class love story, the movie traffics in clichés, but it does so fluently. The clichés here are sturdy to the point of eloquence. From the sexually explicit names of the lovers to the wicked fiancé, Billy Zane's mustache-twirling performance is something that improves on additional viewing. One can see he understood exactly the movie he was in. To Jack's dying Gipper-esque quip, "I don't know about you, but I intend to write a strongly worded letter to the White Star Line about all this." To the blithe repudiation of financial thinking, "Cutting corners to save money is what weakened the ship to begin with." Cameron loves all the familiar stuff. It is amusing to watch the number of times characters simply throw money away into the air in a film that, while shooting, went extravagantly over budget. It is hypocrisy, of course, that wealthy people make films saluting the poor, but let them benignly pretend. Even Lady Chatterley's Lover, a novel that sympathetically portrays a noblewoman's renunciation of her wealth for love, concludes with an afterword by Lawrence that is a multi-paged fury about not having made a dime from foreign sales and pirated copies. One can toss it into the air, but money doesn't really go away that sweetly. One can, nonetheless, dream. One can also admire Titanic's Victor Garber, the Sondheim tenor, who, although he has no songs, plays the ship's architect almost musically. His spoken voice, here in a Belfastian lilt, as lovely and precise as his sung one. The intrepid can even admire the movie's pseudo-hymn, "My Heart Will Go On," sung by Celine Dion, accompanied by a baleful Irish fiddle. Part folk song, part cola anthem, the song struggles valiantly to do operatic work. Its harmonic progression ascends the scale not unlike Wagner, though not really like it either. A cheesy Liebestod may not be more beautiful than a great one, but it can, given its subject and context, be truer. One can also admire Cameron's curtain call of the dead, who, arranged along the ship's mezzanine and sweeping staircase at the end, make a moving tableau when the aged heroine finally revisits them. The camera races, searches, swims like an eager mermaid through the ship until light bursts forth, doors swing open, and it finds them. DiCaprio, a physical actor, turns in a subtle blend of surprise and expectation, but he does not rush forward. He is now pure spirit. He smiles soulfully, extends a hand, and is mercifully quiet. At the end, life has provided and preserved only one golden memory, one great emotional adventure, as random as a lottery ticket. It is both too meager and too rich. Possession and loss at life's close are irrevocably knotted. The ghosts bearing witness applaud. The audience weeps. Only hopeless romantics need to be told yet again that love is an illusion, that it dies, that it is for lunatics, addicts, and fools. The rest of us may occasionally like, even love, a little respite from what we know. This is what Hollywood movies, so humanely, have always been for. 2000. Claudia Roth Pierpont's Passionate Minds. Weekly, the coffee shop near my house has what the owner calls Trivia Tuesday. Anyone who can answer the trivia question posted on the cake case wins a free cup of coffee. One Tuesday not so long ago, I ventured in at around 4 in the afternoon. The question, written in black marker on a white card, was, what American playwright / actress was arrested and jailed for her work? No one that day had answered the question correctly. No one had not said Lillian Hellman. I summoned the cashier, pointed at the sign, and said a little triumphantly, Mae West. I knew the answer because I had recently read a piece about West written for The New Yorker by Claudia Roth Pierpont. I knew that West was arrested on charges of obscenity for her theatrical hit Sex, which she had written under a pen name. She did a week in the lockup on Welfare Island, now Roosevelt Island, and complained only about the underwear. As I drank my free coffee and privately toasted both West and Pierpont, whoever and wherever she was, I began to wonder why it is, in an age when readers know the hobbies of Vladimir Nabokov, the wives of John Updike, the girlfriends of Philip Roth, all fairly private men, we know so little about our women writers. Why did 100 intelligent coffee drinkers imagine that Lillian Hellman had somehow done jail time or that she was also an actress? Why do hardly any of us think of Mae West as a writer at all? And why was the question about Mae West's jail time even considered trivial? It was not remotely on the same level as the queries regarding batting averages and running yardage that usually grace the cake case. Soon my happy, free coffee had become a problem. It is sometimes, as a feminist in the world, difficult to stay pleased. Somewhat to the rescue comes Claudia Roth Pierpont's new collection, Passionate Minds, Women Rewriting the World, which, despite its soporific title, is one of the most ceaselessly interesting books I've read in some time. Within its pages, one will find Pierpont's Mae West piece, which inspired not just Trivia Tuesday, but James Lapine's current stage production, Dirty Blonde, as well as biographical essays on 11 other women writers, Olive Schreiner, Gertrude Stein, Anais Nin, Margaret Mitchell, Zora Neale Hurston, Eudora Welty, Marina Svetaeva, Ayn Rand, Doris Lessing, Hannah Arendt, and Mary McCarthy. There is hardly a woman here who would not be scandalized to find herself in company with most of the others, Pierpont says in her introduction. But she chose these literary women for their influence, different from their literary influence, and for the unorthodox ways they worked out their destinies in an age of momentous transition for their sex. She has organized her book in three sections that deal, broadly speaking, a pun that occurs several times in the book, with issues of sexual freedom, race, and politics. She needn't have. There is so much inevitable overlap in theme, and Pierpont's portraits, written independently of one another, are so far-reaching, despite their brevity, and so thesis-resistant, that not one of them stays put within her diaphanous divisions. It affects the book's quality not at all. Pierpont begins with Olive Schreiner, the only clearly 19th-century writer in the group, though Schreiner stood in opposition to almost everything that typified that century. She grew up in the dry South African wilderness and made her reputation with her very first novel, The Story of an African Farm, which became an international sensation even as it questioned all that conventional Victorian spiritual life had typically held dear. As to sex, God, and race, Schreiner was a free thinker, a suffragette, an agnostic, an anti-apartheidist. These were intellectual commitments and did not arise out of any particularly bold or rebellious temperament, for physically and emotionally she was delicate, shy, ill for much of her life. Within the English libertine circles with which she came to associate, she was by comparison restrained, with a pesky predilection for falling in love. Schreiner was born in 1855, the same year Charlotte Bronte died, and she seems in many ways a continuation of Bronte. They had much in common. Minister father, a bleak childhood in a stark landscape, the early deaths of beloved siblings, fragile health, unusually short stature, work as a governess, an early and determined desire to write, a concern for the predicament of women, and admiration for Wuthering Heights. Although surely Pierpont must have noticed this tie with Bronte, such is the exquisite distillation of her portraiture that the comparison goes unmentioned. She has no room for an observation that may be, well, a little idle. As in all her portraits, she wields a poet's economy. She hasn't the space to wander. Shrewdly, she is after the naughtiest, thorniest things she can find, which are, invariably, the relationship of the writer to her society's impediments, to her love life, and to her mother. Pierpont sees them all as inextricably bound to the story of the writer's work. Schreiner saw her own well-educated English mother as a grand piano closed up and locked and tragically mistaken for a common dining table. She was one of the many mothers described here who had vital unused energies, of which their literary daughters were keenly aware. Schreiner's mother spoke French and Italian, was something of a painter and musician, then married a German missionary, and was consigned on the edge of Busuttu land to a devastating range of household tasks. Owing to a variety of infractions, Gottlob Schreiner had difficulty hanging on to his posts. The feckless colonial father is an element of Doris Lessing's life as well. And the family had to move constantly from mission to mission, often living in wagons. Olive eventually escaped to England, but not without the crucial help of her brother Fred, whom she called Dada. Curiously, among Pierpont's portraits, this is one of only two instances of a brother playing a prominent role in a woman writer's life, the other being Gertrude Stein's brother Leo. Schreiner hoped for a career in medicine. Instead, she became a lifelong patient. Asthma, anxiety, emphysema, heart failure, and a writer. Her manuscript of African Farm was accepted in 1882 by the novelist George Meredith, then a reader for the publishing firm of Chapman and Hill, who swiftly made the novel an international success. The book's penultimate lines give sympathetic voice to Schreiner's modern, science-fed thoughts. The soul's fierce cry for immortality is this, only this. Return to me after death, the thing as it was before. Your immortality is annihilation. Your hereafter is a lie. All dies. All dies. The blasphemous drama of faith, understandably shaken, of doubt sympathetically saluted, was one the world was ready to read. After African Farm, Schreiner's writing came more slowly. She had a love affair with Havelock Ellis, the sex scientist. She fell unrequitedly in love with the mathematician Carl Pearson. She eventually returned to South Africa and married a young farmer who had written her a fan letter. He took her name, gave up his farming, and followed her to England, awaiting the big book she promised to write. She wrote a tract called Women and Labor, which in 1911 re-established her as a social prophet, and in which she claimed to have lost 12 chapters of another larger book to a fire set by British soldiers during the Boer War. Her husband insisted, after her death, that the story was a lie. Their life was not easy, and they separated for 6 years, living on different continents. When she returned to him in Africa, essentially to die, he did not recognize the old woman she'd become. In her loneliness and peripatetic exile, she wrote over 6,000 letters, a fraction of which were later published by her husband, and her political work on behalf of women, blacks, and even Afrikaners. She found the Afrikaner commitment to the land preferable to the rapaciousness of the British colonials, was vigorous and unyielding to the end. Her husband, ever awaiting the big book that would save them financially, was not wholly forgiving. Even after her death, he continued to accuse her of having confused thinking with working. Such an accusation, full of bitter incomprehension, leaves one in a wince of sadness and recognition. The downward turn of the Schreiner narrative typifies that of most of these women of passionate minds. There is no lovely deathbed, its perimeter studded angelically with grandchildren. Tsvetaeva commits suicide, Nin becomes a bigamist, then ill with an excruciating gynecological cancer. West remains a show business joke, but one she is no longer in on. Mitchell is struck and killed by a New York cab before she writes a second book. Hurston, deemed a traitor to her race, lives her last days in obscurity and poverty, working as a maid in Miami. There is no elegant endgame. The end is absurd, at best, a quiet, ordinary mockery. Relatively speaking, Gertrude Stein, Pierpont's second subject, did all right, though this mother of confusion, this author of suspiciously significant nonsense, this literary love child of William James and Tweedledee, died in 1946 just after completing her libretto about Susan B. Anthony, the mother of us all, without ever seeing it staged. A collaboration with Virgil Thompson, it is arguably her most movingly political work. In fact, for the author of the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, collaboration is a rich word indeed, especially in the last years of Stein's life, years that may have goaded and transformed her. Pierpont here characteristically seeks the problem spots, the weird, the unreconcilable, the troubling, as a missile seeks heat. How did Stein and Alice Toklas, two Jews living in occupied France, survive the Nazis? Apparently through the requests of a high-ranking occupation librarian, a friend of theirs, who asked that they not be disturbed. But they were disturbed, though not in the expected manner. German soldiers, it seems, were billeted for a time at their house. Stein and Toklas, ever the hostesses, served dinner. In Stein's now out-of-print Wars I Have Seen, Pierpont says, "One feels her struggling with the effort not to look away. The very term, collabo, which is all she manages to spit out of it, causes her to stumble on the page, falling into a repetitive stutter that seems not a mannerism, but a kind of seizure." Surely the most terrifying and heartbreaking life recounted in these pages is Marina Tsvetaeva's. Born at the same time as Anna Akhmatova, Boris Pasternak, and Osip Mandelstam, she was famous in her day, yet is still the least known of this dazzling Russian quartet whose poetry spans the revolution. Her subject was the torment of passionate sexual love, and her virtually untranslatable poems were often emotional dares, addressed to men she briefly worshipped or desired. Tsvetaeva, the daughter of an aging professor whom her mother, an accomplished pianist, had married on the romantic rebound, had no ideology save romance and provocation. Her own mother's rebellion and longing, she claimed, had grown in her children to the level of a scream. Mandelstam fell in love with Tsvetaeva, as later did Pasternak, but they married others. Tsvetaeva married a tubercular teenager she met at the beach. She wrote poems against the revolution and against the Tsar, And when she was stranded in chaos-stricken Moscow, her husband at war, her family house dismantled for firewood, she wrote plays. She barely managed, dependent on small fees for reciting her work and on friends and handouts for food. The squalor she and her small children lived in became well known. One daughter died of starvation. Tsvetaeva did get out, and for 3 years she lived in Prague with her husband, who had now been drawn into the Soviet Secret Service and was implicated in several murders, including that of Trotsky's son. When her husband fled to Moscow, Tsvetaeva packed her bags and followed him, in Pierpont's words, into hell. Once there, she was no longer a renowned poet, but a pariah, a former supporter of the White Guard and the wife of a by-then-disgraced Soviet agent. Both her husband and her daughter were informers who worked to implicate each other, as well as Tsvetaeva herself. Her daughter was arrested and spent 17 years in prison camps. Her husband was shot in 1941. She herself was taken in by sympathetic strangers and that same year hanged herself in one of their outbuildings. Even Mandelstam's widow, who knew well the tragedies under Stalin, was eventually to claim to know no more terrible a fate than Tsvetaeva's. Tsvetaeva's tale alone, for those unfamiliar with it, is worth the price of Pierpont's book, illustrating as it does the fascination and worth of a writer's life story. In our insatiable age of biography, even when the writer's work has not been much read or made readable. Resourcefulness, artful organization, a keen interest in history, perceptive reading of the available texts, and an intelligent way with gossip are the keys to Pierpont's mesmerizing telling. Moreover, she reminds us to consider the curious detail. The economist Alan Greenspan was once a member of Ayn Rand's inner circle. 18-year-old Hannah Arendt's clandestine meetings with the married Martin Heidegger involved an elaborate signal system of lights switched on and off. The Gone with the Wind film premiere in Atlanta included a costume ball, celebrating the days at Tara Hall, when every man was a master and every man had a slave. It included entertainment by the Ebenezer Baptist Church Choir, and among the onstage pickaninnies was the minister's 10-year-old son, Martin Luther King Jr. Such finds, which Pierpont sometimes confines within parentheses, eloquently reveal the complicated, often surreal landscapes from which cultural figures are both made and freed. Which is not to say that readers will not quarrel with Pierpont. They will. That is part of the pleasure of such a book. Independent-minded, perhaps to a fault, Pierpont herself is an equal opportunity quibbler, though one sometimes suspects that her allergy to groupthink causes her to go out of her way to dispute a feminist or a communist. She occasionally ridicules Lessing. "You can take the woman out of the galaxy, but you can't take the galaxy out of the woman." She turns Ayn Rand into a harmless if grotesque figure of fun. Margaret Mitchell, relegated to a shallow social type, eludes her almost entirely. And she is dismissive of Nin, devoid even of reluctant praise for Nin's intermittently astute writing. The powdered mask and sexual theater that Pierpont so approves of in West, and the promiscuity she disregards in Mary McCarthy, are suddenly completely repellent to her in Nin. As if beauty, availability, and desire weren't sufficient to explain Nin's long list of lovers, she exclaims that Nin must have been simply astonishing in bed, then sets out to prove Nin frigid, which sends a reader to the dictionary to look up the word astonishing, also the word bed. Pierpont has, too, the biographer's predictable habit of looking to the work for the life, but she sometimes takes it a bit further into what might be called the therapeutic fallacy, suggesting that writers are cathartically working out their problems in their writing. She had discovered that the only way to relieve her suffering was by writing, she says of Stein. Saying that writers write from what is on their minds is different from saying they are relieving their suffering, getting better by writing. The distinction is an important one. To venture slightly into Steinese, the only suffering of the writer a writer might relieve by writing is the suffering of not writing. Art is hardly therapy. Pierpont will be most controversial in her take on the deeply gentle, much-loved, and still living Eudora Welty, whose profile she titles with some irony, A Perfect Lady, and whom she correctly notes has entered the national pantheon as a kind of favorite literary aunt, the Pallas Athena of Jackson. One has to applaud Pierpont's sense of justice here with regard to the little things. It is appalling that just about everyone willing to speak about Welty in her youth refers to her physical unattractiveness, as well as to the harder, larger ones. In Pierpont's view, it is Welty's interrupted and eventually unlocatable moral and social discernment that is most disturbing to a reader of her oeuvre. Despite a brilliant interlude as a photographer in the 1930s, when her subject was Mississippi Blacks, Welty seems to have kept from the center of her work the racial story everywhere around her. In Pierpont's mind, Welty has been polite, perhaps blinkered, rarely writing anything that would inconvenience or offend her Jackson, Mississippi neighbors and her residents among them. Welty, now 90, still lives in the house of her childhood. The uncertainly educated denizens of Welty's ingrown post-historic Coca-Cola-sodden South are, to Pierpont, truly akin to monsters, albeit at Welty's dismaying best, entirely guileless and extremely funny ones. The dismaying best says it all, that Welty's work doesn't just record, but too often imitates the social refusal and denial all about it, Pierpont believes, should not be overlooked because of Welty's literary gifts. Pierpont does not address aesthetic ideas of naturalism or that more antique word, regionalism. It does not matter to her that the glancing way in which race is mentioned by Welty might be accurate to the segregated white world she portrays. Pierpont sees Welty as having struck an unholy bargain with the charming South. She would keep its hatred and ugliness out of her work in exchange for acceptance. Such a flat-footed assertion is, of course, both thrilling and naive. It is impossible that a writer of Welty's stature would be capable, even unconsciously, of such a coarse and poisoned contract. One wonders here whether Pierpont has perhaps encountered a generosity of spirit and called it ingratiation. She's also likely flunking Welty in political homework, unassigned to Welty's northern peers. One detects in Pierpont's account a geographical bias. Pierpont also declines to emphasize the complicated ironies and portraits of internal exile that abound in Welty's work. But Pierpont writes well, and so not unpersuasively. Since she is interested less in literary criticism than in the wrong turns of a writer's life, she claims that Welty's alleged spiritual failing and artistic turnaround are attributable to two people Welty loved and desired to please. John Robinson, the attentive, handsome, and homosexual step-grandson of a racist Mississippi governor, and Welty's own overbearing mother. If, upon her father's death, Welty had not had to return from New York, where she was then living, and taken up residence with her mother, her work, Pierpont suggests, might have continued on a very different path. In one of Pierpont's searing parentheticals, she notes that Catherine Ann Porter in 1952 visited Jackson and was incensed when Welty, then 42, had to ask her mother if Porter might come for dinner. To make matters worse, Welty's mother said no. The jazz improvisations and grim social complexities that were included early on in Welty's stories gave way, Pierpont insists, to something akin to the folksy humbug of Will Rogers. Of course, all writers are vulnerable to accusations of having left things out, wittingly or unwittingly, of having avoided or transformed certain things because of the difficulty of addressing them head-on. Often it is a kind of modesty, a writer's underestimation of his or her abilities, that keeps the work, and perhaps the life, so constructed. Welty, by virtue of birthplace and temperament, may be particularly vulnerable to such complaints. When she was growing up, the only black people she appears to have seen were contented servants. According to her own report, quite unremarkably, she questioned nothing. Works such as Delta Wedding appear to Pierpont, and others, to traffic in the flattering local white myths. Quite tellingly, in her 20s, Welty apologized publicly, if a bit sarcastically, for not having been in jail or trodden grapes like other young people. But then, Welty was always famously nice. When her collected stories appeared in 1980, her publisher removed the word nigger from a significant portion. Welty gave her consent. Passionate Minds, with its unintimidated questions and explorations, is provocative and bracing, a wizard's mix of innocence and fire. One can only guess how that playwright-actress Lillian Hellman might have fared within its pages. 2000. Philip Roth's The Human Stain. For admirers of the shrieking lyrical work of Philip Roth, the 1990s were a feast. First came Patrimony, 1991, Roth's magnificent memoir of his father, one of his few books to stir tears not simply of laughter. Then came the intellectually exquisite Operation Shylock, 1993, followed by Sabbath's Theater, 1995, Roth's masterpiece of erotic and tragicomic mourning. Three stunning books in quick succession. It seemed an outpouring of unstoppable, idiosyncratic genius. In terms of sheer productivity, brilliance, distinctly American diction, philosophical rage, comic irritability, dramatic representations of solitude, uniqueness of voice, and unwavering repugnance toward heterosexual convention, it is difficult to think of a contemporary artist with whom Roth might even be compared. If one strains and reaches into another medium entirely, Stephen Sondheim comes to mind. Both have committed their lives to a single, if commercially ailing, art form, provocatively pushing at its margins with piercing wit and multitonal notes, for the avid consumption of the more literate members of an essentially middlebrow audience, their loyal fans. The condition of the fan over time, however, is a complicated one. The fan's admiration may grow proprietary, neurotic, and fussy, conducted no longer in the language of love, but in the unattractive tones of disappointed connoisseurship. Such a condition, with time, resembles something vaguely, if unilaterally, marital, replete with dashed hopes, eccentric pronouncements, insincere forgiveness, nagging, muttering, and some occasional, really extremely minor drinking. So, now we may perhaps to begin, yes? Roth's Pulitzer Prize-winning American Pastoral, 1997, despite its many lively and sharply observed passages, was, to this reader, a falling off from the three books before it. The novel's disdainful depiction of 60s radicals, who are given little of intelligence to do or say, and the portrait of its sweet, hollow hero, appeared fatally under-imagined. American Pastoral was followed by I Married a Communist, 1998, which sometimes seemed cripplingly awash in unwarranted and therefore sentimental emotion. Rage is often Roth's highly effective muse, but it may have failed I Married a Communist because it was made too talky, rendered tonal before it was rendered dramatic. The leading male characters all join forces to heap their disgust upon the female characters just a tad too soon. The novel's events are insufficient up front to subject the narration so quickly to such bile. Of course, T.S. Eliot once made something of the same criticism of Hamlet. Roth's new novel, The Human Stain, loosely belongs to a trio that includes these last two novels. They have many things in common, a nostalgia for old Newark, a handsome hero fool, the handsome hero fool's tell-it-like-it-is brother, and the presence of Nathan Zuckerman, Roth's literary doppelganger, who is observer, bit player, and imaginary channeler of all three novels. Moreover, although none of these novels is a political one per se, each is set in a politicized landscape, positioning a messy family drama within the politically charged setting of the presidential years of Nixon, Eisenhower, and Clinton, respectively. Of the three, The Human Stain is, to this reader, the most interesting book. Its particular hero fool is arguably the most socially intriguing character to whom Roth has ever devoted himself. Jewish identity crises are, of course, Roth's signature subject. His fictional portraits tend to be of Jewish men fashioning for themselves independent ways of being Jewish. Authenticity and existential freedom are his themes, and his narratives generally proceed by argument, often in the form of dialogue. In The Human Stain, Roth gives us Coleman Silk, classics professor at fictional Athena College in Western Massachusetts. Silk is a neighbor of Nathan Zuckerman, as Gatsby was of Nick Carraway, and was also the first and only Jew ever to serve at Athena as dean of faculty. But Silk's Jewishness contains a secret. As it turns out, he is not actually Jewish at all. Roth has given us a man struggling with a truly independent way of being Jewish, pretending to be Jewish. Being Jewish for Coleman Silk means being white. Silk is actually a light-skinned black man, the son of a New Jersey optician, who, in his early 20s, seeing he could pass for white, decided to go ahead, disown his family, and pass. To become a new being, thinks Zuckerman. To bifurcate. The drama that underlies America's story, the high drama that is upping and leaving, and the energy and cruelty that rapturous drive demands. When Silk tells his mother his decision, her stoicism is heartbreaking. To see her future grandchildren, she says, she'll just sit quietly on a park bench if Coleman will walk them by. You tell me the only way I can ever touch my grandchildren is for you to hire me to come over as Mrs. Brown to babysit and put them to bed? I'll do it. Tell me to come over as Mrs. Brown to clean your house. I'll do that. It is a valedictory between mother and son on a par with Hector and his weeping mother, just before Hector is slaughtered by Athena. Not for nothing is Coleman Silk a classic scholar. His favorite book, in fact, is the Iliad. The cost and purposefulness of Silk's reinvention is extraordinary. Even within the fictional world of an author who has written Valentine after Valentine to the idea of trespass. Did he get, from his decision, the adventure he was after, or was the decision in itself the adventure? Was it the social obstruction that he wished to sidestep? Was he merely being another American, and in the great frontier tradition, accepting the democratic invitation to throw your origins overboard, if to do so contributes to the pursuit of happiness? Or was it more than that? Or was it less? It is a decision that Silk's fate comes to mock profoundly. Roth gives Silk a Jew's life, but also a Jew's death. That is, he is singled out as a Jew by an anti-Semite and marked for death. The message of the Kaddish, Zuckerman notes, is, a Jew is dead. Another Jew is dead. As though death were not a consequence of life, but a consequence of having been a Jew. In a novel abounding with harsh ironies, one of the most peculiar is the one the novel begins with, the one that has Silk summoning Zuckerman before him. Professor Silk, we come to learn, has been forced into retirement. 2 years before, he used the word spooks in class, meaning ghosts or phantoms, but it was mistaken for a racial slur, and a complaint was brought against him. When he refused to apologize in any way whatsoever, and instead grew more and more furious, his resignation became inevitable. This incident, he feels, is his tragedy, slaughtered by Athena, for he devoted his life's work to the college as both teacher and esteemed dean. He blames the scandal for the death of his wife, Iris. In the midst of the controversy, she died of a stroke, and in his sorrow and fury continues to alienate not just his colleagues, but his children and friends. He begins writing a book called Spooks and asks Zuckerman to help him with it. Although Zuckerman does not directly help Silk, he begins tentative investigations on behalf of his own book, The Human Stain, a title that clearly refers not just to the taint left upon this earth by our species, but also to the pigmentation that so arbitrarily colors human skin. Zuckerman's imagining of Silk's story leads him to other ones, especially that of Silk's new girlfriend, Fawnia Farley, who is a janitor at Athena College and is a woman so unformed by societal expectations, so unimaginably assaulted by life, that she is accepting of everything Silk could possibly reveal about himself. It was the closest Coleman ever felt to anyone. He loved her. Because that is when you love somebody, when you see them being game in the face of the worst. Not courageous, not heroic, just game. The novel's weakest parts involve hatefully rendered interior monologues of two characters, the first being Lester Farley, Fawnia's psychotic ex-husband and Vietnam veteran, whom Roth seems to construct from every available cliché of the Vietnam vet. The second is Delphine Rue, a lonely young classics professor who dresses like a schoolgirl and becomes the target of Roth's fierce but unconvincing satirical commentary. In what can only be described as a kind of pedophobia, the villains of Roth's last two novels were schoolgirls, spoiled and oddly dangerous to middle-aged men. The book indulges in the sort of tirade against political correctness that is far drearier and more intellectually constricted than political correctness itself. Roth, usually fond of both sides of an argument, fails to extend understanding toward, and only makes fun of, the possible discomfort of minorities or women in settings like Athena, where prejudice may be trickily institutional and atmospheric, causing events like the spook's utterance to be seized hold of and over-interpreted. Such seizing is like nabbing Al Capone for tax evasion, neither accurate nor wrong. And despite the protests against Black History Month, brazenly placed in the mouth of Silk's African-American sister, the novel shows that Zuckerman's education would indeed have benefited from such a month. The novel is strongest and is even magical when Zuckerman is actually present on the page, and in this case, in the room with Coleman Silk, observing him with articulate infatuation. Silk is quick, lithe, charismatic, in ways indomitable. An outgoing, sharp-witted, forcefully smooth, big-city charmer. Something of a warrior, something of an operator. Hardly the prototypical pedantic professor of Latin and Greek. At one point, they foxtrot together on Silk's porch. "Come, let's dance," says Silk, bare-chested and in shorts, hearing a Sinatra song on the radio. "But you mustn't sing into my ear," says Zuckerman, who, once he is dancing, adds, "I hope nobody from the volunteer fire department drives by." The homoerotic moments in The Human Stain are not overtly carnal, but playful and warm-hearted. At one point, the book even contemplates the sexual allure of Milan Kundera, from the point of view of Delphine Rue, but still. As a writer, Roth knows how to have fun. In addition to the hypnotic creation of Coleman Silk, who many readers will feel, correctly or not, to be partly inspired by the late Anatole Breuillard, Roth has brought Nathan Zuckerman into old age, continuing what he began in American Pastoral. Alone, prostateless, now outside the sexual fray, Zuckerman has become a melancholic poet of twilight and chagrin. The combination of perspicacity and weary tranquility becomes him as a narrator. He is like that beloved American character, the retired private eye, brought back in for one more case. When he accidentally befriends an African American, the national story of race opens up for him in all its particularities, or rather, one fascinating set of them. He says of Silk, "The dance that sealed our friendship was also what made his disaster my subject, and made his disguise my subject, and made the proper presentation of his secret my problem to solve. That was how I ceased being able to live apart from the turbulence and intensity that I had fled. I did no more than find a friend, and all the world's malice came rushing in." The Human Stain is an astonishing, uneven, and often very beautiful book. 2000. Matthew Clam's Sam the Cat. Before Robert Gottlieb became editor of The New Yorker for a brief 5-year term from 1987 to 1992, the fiction printed in the magazine was famous, among those associated with smaller literary magazines, for its squeamish gentility. No body fluids, sounds, or smells were permitted in its pages. Other banished and corrupting vulgarities included the word wig instead of hairpiece, as well as the barbarism yellow light. One was required to say amber light when writing of a traffic signal. Of the several young fiction writers who came speeding headlong through the amber light of Gottlieb's interregnum, no one seemed more provocatively expressive of current American vernacular, in its white male form, than the then 27-year-old Matthew Clam. The narrative voice of Sam the Cat, his first of 7 stories to be published in The New Yorker, was so alarmingly, vitally full of forbidden utterance that it seemed to set the pages of the magazine on fire. "The downstairs smelled like cat piss," that first story read, worrying the line between candor and scatology. "Skippy's litter box was like an overflowing minefield." If its youthful anti-heroics and attention to style and myth made it seem quite a legitimate descendant of John Updike's renowned A&P, the helpless prurience and bumbling belligerence of its voice owed something to the theatrical monologues of Lenny Bruce and Spalding Gray. You walk into a supermarket or a restaurant. Your girlfriend goes in first, and you're looking at her ass. And you say to yourself, "Isn't that the most beautiful ass? That's mine. It's beautiful." Like it's going to save you. An ass isn't going to save you. What's it going to do? Hide you from the police? The story was greeted at the time with dismay, shock, and delight, sometimes simultaneously in a single reader. How interesting to reread it now, these 9 years later, as the title story of Clam's long-awaited first collection. Its lunacy is no longer shock. Of course, one should hardly need reminding that timing and context are everything where provocative art is concerned. Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint was shocking when it first appeared in 1969, no longer shocking in the 1970s, then shocking again in 1990. I taught it that year to students, many raised on women's studies curricula, who were taken aback in a manner few students in the 1970s would have been. Meanwhile, in the year 2000, what opens up before the reader of Matthew Clam, once the transgressive effects of his fiction soften or are no longer experienced at all, is the enduring comedy and essential sweetness of his work. He is mostly too interested in confusion to be brutal. "I try to laugh as much as possible," says one narrator. Clam does not traffic much in sustained fury or hate, a difficult accomplishment for comic writers, and is oddly frequently interested in justice. "If I were a girl, I'd fuck 10 guys a day," declares Sam the Cat, the boilerplate Clam protagonist. "I swear, I'd never want to be a girl, though, for they have the worst deal in history." Sam Moore confesses then narrates, and his confession has to do with a sudden crush he develops on a man in a rock band. I went home and shut my eyes and tried to sleep, except there was this guy, the guy who looked like a chick, walking around the party in my mind. I watched him walk up to the bartender. I saw him reach into the front pocket to get money, and I saw how his round butt stuck out a little. Somebody stop me. No one does, not even his current girlfriend, who holds the receiver near the grinding Cuisinart when he phones. He gets a makeover at the mall. He shows up at the musician's door bearing flowers. The musician turns out to be straight. Girls, I mean women, it's a crazy thing, Sam says wildly to the musician. However undomesticated, Clam's narrators seldom put anything forward unapologetically. They apologize compulsively in virtually every story. I'm sorry, why did I say that? Is it too late to take it back? Is practically a refrain. They beg and amuse for mercy. They speak like recovering altar boys. Mother of God, listen to the way I'm talking, says Sam. Says another narrator. When I hate Lynn, or when I can't stand to look at her or be near her, when I feel putrid, when I wish God would just erase me, I look at the garden. Their assaultive imaginations, lunging at love, then puzzling over its elusiveness, seldom spare themselves. Am I a good person or a bad person? Asks one narrator. I'm not a great person. I know that. Says another. I'll tell you who I should marry. Myself. Their bravado is laughingly gossamer. I'm a fantastic lover. I've got to give me that. Sam's fantasies, of course, are the stuff of childhood. We could sail around the world together. The ship would be my kingdom. I'd have a sword and an eye patch, some movies on video below decks for when the wind dies. I'd love the seagoing life. He remains the eternal boy, his desire incited mostly by thoughts of itself. Note the classic crescendo of neurosis. I almost want her back. It's not a joke. I'd do anything to get her back. Passion is inflated by words. Gesture brings momentary conviction. I've had a girlfriend since I was in second grade, he says. All he knows of love deriving from that time. And I'll probably have one until I croak. Girlfriends in Matthew Clam's world are the sanctuary from the pursuit of other girlfriends, and erotic farce is his primary focus in the early stories. But what soon emerges to eclipse this as the stories proceed and grow through the collection is Clam's skillful social satire. His stories from the second one on begin to become studies of the toxicity of American affluence. Clam guiltily reviles the rich. They are absurd and repellent, and also the only people he knows, and one after another he positions his protagonists as feckless young spies among them. A lot of people go to Harvard, he has one narrator say. I didn't. His world bursts preposterously with plutocrats. There is this from a fellow guest at the Caribbean resort of the Royal Palms. He told me there were guys out there living 40 feet up in the trees, pot growers with machine guns who almost shot him but then took him in and befriended him. He said they were the most amiable guys. And he talked with them and smoked pot and sang reggae. They gave him a tour of their jungle hideout. They'd made crude musical instruments out of tin boxes and wire, and they had their feet propped up on crates of ammo. He said, one of them went to Oxford. His characters know the kings of tiny islands off Sri Lanka, or call Al Gore Al, says the just barely straight-faced narrator of Linda's Daddy's Loaded. We met an interesting group of people when we moved in. All our neighbors who'd built elegant houses out here like ours. The men worked in the city, and the women were all psychologists. By the end of the book, we are, for long stretches, in the grip of strategically piercing and culturally observant work. The one exception, there should be a name for it, a story about an abortion, is the weakest in the collection. The subject is not the right match for Clam's untethered nuttiness, and is a difficult one anyway for the swiftness and antic melancholy of the story form. Perhaps only Hills Like White Elephants, 1927 by Ernest Hemingway, and Day-Old Baby Rats, 1972, by the underknown and now deceased New Yorker writer Julie Hayden, have done it well. In Not This, Clam's narrator discovers with alarm that his brother's newly acquired wealth is from public relations work he does solely for the mafia. He wiped his eyes with the palm of his hand and said, "But look, they're going to make us a pool," pointing with the telephone. In the Royal Palms, the protagonist's professional life thrives while his marriage falls flat. We had more money now, but what were we going to do next? Something was missing. We needed the next phase, and we needed what was missing to get to the next phase. In Linda's Daddy's Loaded, the husband says, in perfect Clam rhythm, "We had a glorious yard, a beautiful pool, sliding glass doors leading out to a patio, lawn chairs with pillows, a dog, a special electric fence to keep the dog from running away, a thing on his collar to shock him if he tried, track lighting in the kitchen, a marble pastry block." It is the dog, glancingly brutalized and tucked between pillows and track lighting, that best typifies not just the skilled comic sequencing of Clam's writing, but its strugglingly moral and socially stunned heart. All of Clam's gifts and themes are in symphonic display in the last two stories of the collection, Issues I Dealt With in Therapy and European Wedding. These are Clam's longest and most artistically accomplished narratives. If it were not such a spiritual misdescription, one might here use the word mature, though they emerge naturally from a voice and style established at the book's start. The breath and skin quality of every girlfriend or wife continues to be noted clinically for abnormalities, but his real scrutiny is saved for larger game. Social class, ethical identity, the Faustian bargains of the young, and the story's erotic matters are wrapped up with ribbons of idiosyncratic uxoriousness. The bitterly but cleverly titled Issues I Dealt With in Therapy, there is no therapy session in the story, or even a mention of one, is set on a preppy East Coast resort island at the wedding of the narrator's incredible friend Bob. Bob is an old, formerly progressive pal who studied civil rights law and worked to desegregate a school district in Mississippi. Clam's nameless narrator, who works at a nonprofit that attacked the military-industrial complex, but I'll tell you right now, it did nothing, worships his incredible friend Bob. But then Bob wins a big case. Soon he was having chats with Janet Reno, riding with her over to Congress. They had some sticky problems in immigration and naturalization. They were trying to figure out how to throw Haitians back in the water. When I phoned him at work, he could only whisper. Bob had whole families, Rwandans who were here seeking asylum, removed from the homes where relief agencies had put them, shipped back to Africa for sure death. Afterward, Bob became a media catastrophe consultant. He befriended politicians under fire. When asked to toast the groom, Clam's now unbeguiled narrator begins, "You've had a lot of jobs, Bob. Unfortunately, I'm blanking on some of your successes." The testimonial builds angrily for several pages, including advice for the bride, "Stand up and start running and never look back," and maybe the funniest wedding toast since the one Robert Cohen wrote in his 1996 novel, The Here and Now. "That," says Clam's narrator's girlfriend when he finally sits down, "was a disaster." Lest we forget that Clam desperately desires a comedic world, he closes his collection with not one, but two weddings. European Wedding, the book's ultimate story, is also the first and only one Clam has written in the third person. This point of view, allowing him the perspectives of three separate characters, serves him well, and he it. Up until this story, the book that Sam the Cat may most resemble is Julie Hecht's amusing Do the Windows Open, 1997, whose stories also appeared in The New Yorker, and registered the gender-related vanities and anxieties of East Coast metropolitan society, drawing repeatedly from a single ongoing personality for its narratives. Hecht created a book-length vocal solo, even though it was a collection, and Clam comes close to doing the same. The third person of